Well, thanks, Kel, and welcome, everybody. Good evening or good afternoon or good morning, depending where you're hailing from. Appreciate the 40 minutes to carry a message. I've done it in less, but 40 minutes is a good period of time, so I appreciate that. And thank you for the reading. You know, we hear that reading so often in our meetings, and sometimes I wonder if we just kind of tune out because we hear it every day. You know, rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed the path. I've carried the message. I keep track of everyone I've ever carried the message to. It's a little over 5,000 to date. I do a workshop called 12 Steps in 4 Hours. We've taken over 5,000 people through that process. And out of that mix, I've taken almost 400 people one-on-one through the 12 steps over the last 18 years. And I've buried 41 to date. 41 that I've worked with are dead. I bury most people to alcohol death. Still the most dangerous drug out there. Kill you when you drink it. Kill you when you detox from it. So rarely do I see it. Now, out of the 5,000 people I've carried through those steps, I've been fired like 2,500 times as a sponsor. Rarely do I find someone who will thoroughly follow the steps. Most don't make it. I know that's awful news, but most don't make it. And there's a reason for that. To thoroughly follow the path. Well, what does that mean? What is this path that we're on? What does that look like? And there's a lot of things bandied about the rooms that aren't really what our program's about. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely. You know, I love those words, thoroughly followed, completely give themselves to our simple program. It's like no half measures, right? None of us ever half measured our using. So why do we see so much half measuring of our program? And it goes on to say, usually men and women are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. I refer to these types of people as WOFT, W-O-F-T, waste of fucking time. And I meet a lot of WASPs in the rooms of 12 steps. We thought we could find an easier, softer way. By the way, if anybody here finds an easier, softer way, I would hope you'd have the decency to call me and let me know what it is, because I sure as hell haven't been able to find one. And as it says, but we could not. Half measures availed us nothing. So, you know, one of the things I love about Zoom, especially because it's reduced our fellowship to that of the global village, and we can carry our message and we can work with addicts around the world with this amazing medium we call Zoom. And, you know, I always ask the question, are you working your program? And I get so many different responses to that question. The most common one I get is, oh, I go to meetings. I go to meetings every day, sometimes 3 meetings a day. Meeting makers make it. 90 and 90. And I go, no, that's not really what I'm talking about. Are you working with someone? Now, the next most common response I get is, oh yeah, I've got a sponsor. I call my sponsor every day. If I miss calling my sponsor, I run the risk of being fired by my sponsor. My sponsor makes all my decisions. It tells me who I can sleep with, how to manage my money. You know, a lot of crazy ass shit that comes out of some sponsors. And I remember one person called me up and she was so pissed with her sponsor. I said, well, what's going on? She said, well, my sponsor told me that in order to recover, I have to clean his house twice a week. And I ain't getting any better. And I thought, you know, well, Dr. Bob did say clean house, but I don't think he meant it quite so literally, right? But this is the kind of shit I hear coming out of sponsors. I remember another person was telling me their sponsor told them in order to show willingness, they had to go to the largest meeting in person in Toronto, which was about 300 people in their pajamas to show willingness. I think, who comes up with this kind of stuff? Well, I was talking to a guy recently who was building a deck in his backyard, and he's at the hardware store. And we're chatting. He says, Cameron, I got to go. I got to call my sponsor, let him know what screws I'm buying for the deck. And I'm thinking, someone's got a screw loose here, right? Calling your sponsor to make sure you're making the right decision on deck screws. Like, I hear all kinds of inane things. And I go, no, that's not what I'm talking about. Are you working with newcomers? And they look at me like I got 3 bloody heads on. Now, in CA, in all fairness, I find CA, there's a lot more sense of urgency. Sometimes from the podium, although I get into trouble for it, I often say AA is a retirement home for grumpy old men. NA's the fucking insane asylum, and CA's the emergency ward. We're serious about recovery. We got a solution. Come on in. We're doing soul surgery here. I love that about CA. And, but, you know, often they look at me like they got three heads. I got three heads on. They go, what do you mean newcomers? I'm still a newcomer. I've been only in the program 2 years. This is a selfish program. I got to work on me first. And I never see those people hang around the rooms for very long. Now, addicts have this ability. The untreated addict has this ability. They like digging holes. You know, we dig holes out there in our untreated addiction and alcoholism. And we dig very deep holes. And being the nature of the untreated addict, we fall into the hole. And then we're stuck and we cry out for help. And people come along to try to help us. Now, the first people that usually try to help the untreated addict down in their hole are the family members. You know, they come by, the wife, the children, friends, the employer, and they offer us those frothy emotional appeals. Don't you see how much we love you? They bail us out of trouble. They're forever extending that ladder down in the hole and saying, hey, please climb out and be with us. But what does the addict do, especially the crackhead? They trade the ladder in for a 20-piece. They go out on another run and they dig their hole a little deeper, right? And they're stuck. And as they cry out for help, other people in society come by to try to help us. The religious community comes by and they say, here, we have a solution for you. Let us read this scripture. I will kneel and pray with you for a while. But because it's a program of faith without works, that avails the untreated addict very little power, and they remain stuck in their holes. The medical community comes by. They're very motivated to find solutions for us. And they're forever coming up with great ideas like antabuse, Suboxone, methadone, clorazepam, diazepam, perazepam. I remember my doctor saying to me, he says, Cameron, you're depressed. I said, you think? You know, I burned my life to the ground. Nobody likes me. Nobody wants to be around me. I got nothing going on. I'm bankrupt physically, emotionally, mentally, spiritually. And I'm trying to get off pills. I don't need more pills in my life. And the trouble with the pill solution, the pharmaceutical solution, is that, you know, the prescriptions run out. Then the pills run out, and then that awful pain of being an untreated addict comes to bear down upon us. And we realize, hey, I'm still in this hole. And then finally we have the treatment center communities. I poke fun at the treatment center communities. I know they try to be helpful in their multi-billion dollar ways and their two-year college-educated addiction counselor. And they cry out and they say, here, we got a solution for you. It's called group. Let's sit in a circle. And the trouble with this approach is they bring this into our meetings. You may have attended a meeting like this. I call them open, disgusting meetings, where you sit in a circle. There's no solution. There's no crosstalk or cross-sharing. It's just a circle of problems. Problem, 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 like an incessant Oprah wine fest. It's group therapy without a therapist. And there's no solution. And by the end of the meeting, I am a psychological casualty of this particular meeting. There's been no hope. There's been no faith. There's been no courage. And now I need a meeting to fix the meeting I was supposed to get that at. You ever been to one of those meetings? They're awful. I don't know why. Our book says we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection. Why? Because it diminishes our usefulness to others. Yet I see it all the time in the rooms, this kind of an approach. And the counselors, they always love to ask that question. How do you feel? How are you feeling? And I'm thinking, as an untreated addict, I have only two feelings. I feel like using and I feel like murdering you. Those are the only two feelings I have as an untreated addict, right? I'm irritable and restless and just downright pissy, right? And then, of course, after about an hour of sharing, the counselor says, you know, you're all beautiful people, but I practice a professional class of therapy, and I got to go pick up my paycheck, but I'll see you next week. And the untreated addict realizes, hey, I'm still in the hole. Now, I got good news and bad news. The good news is there is a way out of the hole. The bad news is, like rarely do we see a person fail to thoroughly follow the path, is that most addicts are too selfish, too self-centered, too self-seeking, frightened to do the work, and you're going to die. And it's going to be an awful death. Like I said, I've buried 41 that I've worked with directly, and I've lost count over the hundreds of others that I've heard in the program pass on who could not, would not do this way of life. Now, part of the good news is there is a way out, and it's a simple way out. I teach the program in 4 hours. I say it only takes a few hours to learn it, the rest of your life to practice it. So our stories are supposed to disclose in a general way what we're like, what happened, and what we're like today. You know, what we were like, you know, so often I hear, you know, when people construe this part of their story, it's often what it was like. And you get that proverbial war story, right? I always know I'm in for a long war story when someone goes to the front of the room and goes, I remember my first drink. I was in my mother's third trimester, and I realized I didn't drink like other fetuses. And I go, oh God, here we go, right? And they forever, you know, elaborate on their war story of all their drinking and using. You know, I already know how to drink and use. Is there anyone here today that doesn't know how to drink or use? Any novices, any newbies to the program here? You don't know how to, you know, we're all experts in drinking and using. So I don't need to hear that part. I need to hear enough that, you know, you can qualify as one of us, but I don't need to have it belabored. What I really want to know, is there a way out of the hole? So as I said, our stories are supposed to disclose in a general way what we're like, what happened, what we're like today. So what am I like as an untreated addict? From the age of 20 to the age of 46, I like drinking, using. I like it more than anything else on the planet. I like it more than every job I've been fired from. I got so bad where I thought, well, I can't go on like this, so I'll start my own company. That way I can't fire myself. But clients have a habit of firing you. I love it more than my children. I was an intravenous cocaine user. And I would often share needles with people. And then being the irresponsible man I am, I would leave my dirty tools laying around the house. And I remember one morning waking up after a debacle and seeing my 4-year-old son with my neighbor's kid, who was about the same age, playing squirt guns with one of my dirty needles. And I felt really awful as a father, but that did not have the power to sober me up. I like the effect of alcohol and drugs more than my own kids. I like it more than my marriage. My wife would beg and plead and offer those frothy emotional appeals, threaten me with divorce. But I like it more than my marriage. I like it so much, that effect that I get, that I'm willing to risk my life for it. In the year 2000, my doctor diagnosed me with liver disease. He said, Cameron, if you don't stop drinking, you're going to die. And, you know, the first thought that crossed my mind was, is I need a drink right now. That was awful news. And drank for 3 more years on that news. Now, normal people don't understand that. I call the normies, I never liked the word normies. I call them muggles, which is a Harry Potter term for non-wizard. My wife's a muggle. You know, when she has a drink, she gets, you know, kind of a warm and fuzzy feeling. But then she gets a little nauseous. And after the first drink, she just stops. I think, how does she do that? I can't do that. I start drinking. It's like, wow. Let's bring it on. I want to be this way 24/7. So I love the effect more than everything. And in the beginning, it seemed like the answer. I'm generally restless, irritable, discontented, bored, depressed, nervous, shy, all those things I don't like about myself. So my solution to that is to drink and use drugs. It's not my problem. It's my solution. Running out's a problem. But drinking and drugging's my solution. And in the beginning, it seemed like the answer. Remember when we first started using or we first started drinking and that amazing effect that we got? And we thought, yeah, this is what I want. This is the way I like to feel. And it seemed like the answer in the beginning. The problem is, as it rolls out, it gets darker and darker. And, you know, it got to a point where I burned my life to the ground, and yet I still can't seem to stop. I always use the analogy, I'm like a dog that returns to its own vomit. You ever seen a dog eat something that makes it foully sick, and then it throws it up, and then what does the dog do? It eats the vomit, only to throw it up again, right? That's what I'm like as an untreated addict. I'm like a dog that continuously returns to the vomit. Why? Because I can't figure out in my head what's really going on. I got this twist of thinking. Our big book calls it that mental blank spot. I call it the liar. I got a liar that lives in my head. The liar loves the effect produced by drugs and alcohol, and under no circumstances does it want to give it up. So what it's done is it's built this research institute in my brain called Bullshit Inc. And it is researching new ideas and new excuses and new justifications and reasons. Even though my life has been burned to the ground, this time when I do it, it's going to be okay. Somehow, some way, I'm going to be able to control and enjoy this particular spree. Right? We all relate to that liar, right? We all relate to that liar that lives in our head trying to convince us why we should go out again. And the problem is the liar would always win the argument. Untreated, my liar always won the argument. And as the illness rolled out, it became darker and darker where I'd like to tell you, I'm just going to go to the pub, have a few pints, maybe a shot of bourbon or two and come home. But once I start, I can't seem to predict what that's going to look like. It might last a night, could last a day, a week, a month, go on for a year or more. I have no idea. And then what happens is I reach a point in the debacle where I go, I can't go on like this. I have a moment of clarity. I come up for air and I make a firm resolution because I'm full of horror and remorse and hopelessness. I make a firm resolution not to do it again. And we've all done that, right? Coming off those sprees. I'm convinced if we hooked up any one of us to lie detector tests and asked if we were truthful about our resolve, it would register as truthful for all of us. We mean it with all our heart. But what happens? We hear, what should we do? Well, you go to meetings, you go to 12-step meetings, you know? And I go into these 12-step meetings. I know I can't live with the booze and drugs anymore, but I don't know how to live without it. And unfortunately, I find myself in one of those open, disgusting meetings where there's no solution. And I enter into what I call sobriety, where I got no solution. I'm just sheer white knuckling it. Just for today, I'm not going to drink or use. I go into sobriety and then I start experiencing the symptoms of my untreated addiction. I get restless, irritable, discontented, bored, depressed. The liar comes out of remission and says, hey, we need our solution. And it starts working on a reason. And the liar would always win the argument. I would succumb to the desire again, and out I go. And I go around that wheel of misfortune. Spree, remorse, resolution. Spree, remorse, resolution. And round I go, pursuing my love of drinking and drugging to the gates of insanity or death. Raise your hand if you know someone who's died from addiction, right? We all know someone, at least one, if not more. If we got it, it's a death sentence. And this is the horrifying conclusion of step one. Nothing secular, nothing human will stop this train wreck from having another drink or drug. And that's an awful conclusion because I want to stop and I can't. One other problem in the rooms I see when people come in and they go into sobriety, they've got no solution. They don't necessarily relapse. What happens is they go insane. You might have met some of these people, 5, 10 years sobriety, but whatever they got, you don't want it because they're miserable. They're literally crazy. And the suicide rates in the rooms of 12 steps are 80 times higher than normal society. An untreated addict is 80 times more likely to take their own life in their 5 years of untreated sobriety. And that's a real problem. Out of the 41 that I buried, 9 hung themselves in sobriety. They took their own lives. They had no way. They knew they couldn't live with it anymore, but they didn't know how to live without it and went crazy and took their own lives. And that's a real problem. And this is the horrifying conclusion of step one. Step one is awful. I realize I'm going to die on step one. I'm going to drink. I'm going to use again. And to do that is to die. Yet as a member of Cocaine Anonymous, it's been over 18 years since I've had any desire to drink or use. I'm an alcoholic addict who doesn't drink or use. Now that's a paradox. That's a paradox of our program. Because everything in my experience tells me I will, and yet I don't. And it was because I was fortunate enough to meet someone in these rooms who was armed with the facts. They knew what it was like to live in that hole. More importantly, they had a solution and a generosity of spirit as ex-problem addicts and showed me a way out. And because of this program, I've been able to rebuild my life. I'm 65 this year. And in the last 18 years of my sobriety, I rebuilt a destroyed marriage. I was a violent alcoholic addict. I would terrorize my wife and children. My wife and I are celebrating 32 years of marriage. She's my best friend and my business partner and my confidant and soulmate. My children, my daughter's 35, my son's 38, and they wanted nothing to do with me in the end. They just couldn't be around me. I was so angry all the time, murderous rages. And my daughter sees me every week. She comes over to have dinner with my wife and I, and we play cards and watch movies, and we have a really, really nice visit once a week. My son's 38. He has an 11-year-old autistic boy, severe autism. And, you know, for me to be sober, for me to be helpful to him and his challenges, that's a gift CA gives me in day in, day out. My liver went back to normal after 6 years. And another miracle of this amazing program. And, you know, our big book talks about go out and see what other religious people are doing. So being the typical obsessive compulsive addict that I am, I thought, I'll go to university. I'll get a degree. So in my 50s, I enrolled in the University of Toronto, 18th ranked Ivy League university in the world, and graduated at the top of my class in medical anthropology and religions. By the way, I see 3 real good predictors of recovery. 1, we work with others. 2, we go back to school. We fix ourselves. We improve ourselves for our families and our careers. You know what the third thing I see addicts do that tell me they got good recovery? They fix their teeth. I don't know what it is about teeth, but who's got money for teeth when we're out there, right? So when I see people doing all 3 of those things, I know they got a pretty good program. So I graduated in 2016. I've been involved in CA service. I love service. It's the icing on the cake, taking the principles of our steps and the principles of our traditions and then actualizing them at a group level or a district or area level or even at the world level. And to see your message carry across that medium, man, that's the icing on the cake. I've started groups. I've been GSR, secretary, treasurer. I've done most of the positions at area. I've served on 9 conventions. I'm currently the World Archive chair out of LA. I'm the OSA, one of 3 delegates, and the OSA archive chair, as well as the Southern Ontario archivist. Man, I love CA. God gave me a big mouth and a lot of energy to give, to be of maximum service to Cocaine Anonymous and its fellowship. And I really love it. It's taking me around the world prior to COVID and actually just starting up again. I've been to Spain, Sweden, England, all across the United States, Canada. I was just invited by the Dutch to go to Holland in July. Back down in Florida this September. Like, man, it just keeps on giving. It is a stellar life being a member of Cocaine Anonymous. And that's why I like to designate myself a member as Cocaine Anonymous rather than an addict, because there's a big difference between being a member of this amazing fellowship and being an untreated addict. So that's what it was like, and that's what I'm like today. So what happened? Well, I came into these rooms, as I said, and I met this man who was armed with the facts and a generosity of spirit and a common solution, and he was watching me die. I was in 8 months of sobriety. And he says, Cameron, I'm watching you die. Let me show you how to work a program. So instead of going to another meeting, we went to a coffee shop and we opened up Big Books. And we started working the solution. And the first thing he said to me was, he says, Cameron, you're going to be a sponsor. The whole foundation stone of your recovery is you being a sponsor, of you being of maximum usefulness to God and your fellows through sponsorship. He mentioned that in the first 88 pages of the Big Book, before we get into the chapter working with others, that it mentions working with another alcoholic 124 times. Work with another alcoholic. And they don't mean your sponsor. They mean work with the guy or the gal that's in the hole and show them a way out. Because it only takes a day to learn it and the rest of your life to work it. I was at university. I did a paper and it was on an alternative healing system, which is AA or the 12 steps. And I came across this Baltimore, Maryland drug study. And I often cite it. And if there's any academics on the channel and you like reading journals, which, by the way, are the greatest sleeping pill going. This Baltimore, Maryland drug study was done in the year 2000. And they had 500 injection drug users. And they had three groups in this test sample as they watched them go into the rooms of AA and NA at the time. They had those with sponsors, those without sponsors, and those that sponsored others. And at the end of 1 year, they looked at the status, the sobriety status of these three groups. Now, those with sponsors and those without sponsors, there was no difference in their sobriety, which was about 30%. Now, that signified two things. One, you're just as likely to sober up on your own power, with or without a sponsor. And having a sponsor is no predication of power. I am not the power. You know, a lot of people worship the fingers that point to the power, the sponsor, the Big Book, you know, the meetings, CA, you know, that's not the power. It points to the power, but that's not the power. I will fail the newcomer as a power. I'm going to say something that's either going to piss you off or I'm not going to be there when you need me the most. I will fail you as a power. But those that worked with others, 75% of the group was still sober at the end of the first year, signifying all the power, all the efficacy of a 12-step program is availed to us when we sponsor others. We get to keep it by giving it away. We pay it forward to the newcomer. That's another paradox of our program. It's not a selfish program. Whenever I worked on me first, I could never stay sober. But when I cared more about you and gave of myself unconditionally to you to help you get well, my sobriety was always there as a gift, as a grace of God itself. And that's the paradox of our program. I'm a Big Book sponsor. I use the Big Book narrative as my basic recovery text, along with my experience and the experience of the newcomer. And I bring those three elements together, and I've seen a lot of miracles over the years. Over 2,000 miracles working with men and women and addicts all over the world who have the honesty, willingness, and open-mindedness to do the work that we ask them to do. You know, the biggest controversy I have in the rooms is how fast should we work the steps? You know, some people say take a year. Some people say, no, you got to do it faster than that. Sometimes 12 to 14 weeks. I do it in roughly 7 to 10 days. Because if lack of power is our dilemma, what's the likelihood you're going to go back out without power? It's usually pretty high, if not 100%. So let's go find the power now. Let's connect to this dope now and find a way to do it. And the old timers always worked it fast. You know, Bill Wilson was 7 days detox when he started frantically looking for other alcoholics to work with. Abby Thatcher was 60 days sober when he carried the message to Bill. Dr. Bob was 2 weeks sober when he carried the message to Bill Dotson, AA number 3. They all worked it quickly because they all knew the power and the efficacy of the program was getting through the steps, working that program, and being helpful to those that still suffer. Now, in step 2, it says, came to believe in a power greater than ourselves, which would restore us to sanity. You know, what I love about step 2 is it came to believe. That infers we're going to go through a process of working steps, where our minds are going to awaken to this power. Most addicts, when they come in the rooms, are barely toilet-trained apes. They eat, they defecate, they fornicate, and that's about all they're really good for. But, you know, these prefrontal lobes we have, God's gift of evolution, allows us to transcend that reptilian fight-flight brain and have a divine experience where we can intuitively solve the most baffling situations. That sixth sense, that ability to be in that position of neutrality, proacting rather than reacting. But most addicts are asleep when they come into the rooms. And, you know, there's three things in order to take step two. One is, let the testimony of others bear witness to it, to sweep away our prejudice. Y'all think of someone you know who's just like you, who's gone down the rabbit hole as far as you have, if not further, but claims a power greater than themselves restored them to sanity. Let their testimony bear witness to this power at play. The second thing is the ability to be honest. And the third thing, here's another paradox of our program. Where do we find this power greater than ourselves? Not only greater than ourselves, but greater than the booze, greater than the drugs. Where do we find this power? Deep down within ourselves. That's why when I hear things like doorknobs and trees and sponsors as your power, you're looking in the wrong spot. We find the great reality deep down within ourselves. That's the key, and that's the paradox. You know, a great American sponsor, Mark Houston, who passed away many years ago, used to tell a story to illustrate this nature of being asleep as addicts. And he talks about this guy going duck hunting with his buddy, and he brings his dog, and he shoots a duck, and it drops in the middle of the pond, and his dog gets up and walks across the water, picks up the duck, and brings it back. But his friend doesn't say anything. He shoots another duck, drops in the middle of the pond. The dog gets up, walks on the water, picks up the duck and brings it back. Still, he doesn't say anything. So he turns to his buddy and he says, "Hey, do you see anything wrong with my dog?" And the guy goes, "Yeah, that dog can't swim." Missing the miracle of a dog walking on water. You know, those of you on this channel who are self-admitted addicts who don't use anymore, that's the dog walking on water. And that's why it's so important that we share our story. Every one of us has a story to tell. And it's an important story, that story of hope, faith, and courage, because somewhere in our fellowship, there's an ear that desperately needs to hear it, where they realize, hey, I'm like you, you're like me, but you don't do it anymore. I want what you have. And we can take them on that amazing journey we call the 12 Steps of Cocaine Anonymous and show them how to recover. And to bear witness to that, man, that's an amazing thing to play a part of. So in step three, I go, I know there's power out there. So let's go find this power. And I make a decision to fire the liar, in my head, and seek a new employer. I'm going to seek God. I'm going into the God business now. I am an employee of God Inc. I'm an agent of God. Wouldn't that be a cool business card to hand out in the rooms? Hi, my name's Cameron Epp, agent of God. How can I be helpful, right? Because that's what we are in this program. We make a decision to go into the God Inc. business. We're going to fire the liar, go into God Inc. And, you know, we're given that amazing affirmation, that prayer, that step three prayer and meditation where every day I make this decision. I don't need to do steps one and two anymore. That foundation stone and cornerstone is fixed in place. But that keystone I do every day. I consider step three my daily baptism. Every day I baptize myself into this program and I start my day with that morning prayer and then meditate. What will God's will look like in my day when I'm with family, when I'm in the rooms, when I'm helping others, etc.? You see, a lot of people think 12 steps is about quitting. But if you really understand the program, we can't quit. Step one tells me I will drink and use again. So instead, what we're given is a different way of living. By doing God's will, just for today, I'm going to do God's will. I'm going to be honest, pure, unselfish, and loving. And in doing so, in all my affairs, I access a power that lets me easily control that desire to drink, to use, or if you suffer from the acting out addictions like sex, food, or whatever, it has a lot of efficacy in that respect too. And that's the key. Now, the first time I tried to connect to the power, I was so cluttered in my mind. Resentments, fears, guilt, shame over the harm I'd done. I needed to clear that out. So in steps 4 and 5, we go through a process where we get right with ourselves. We understand what blocks us from God, those character defects, those shortcomings, those root causes and conditions. And through that process, we can take those defects, invert them into spiritual principles, and now we have a way out. So after I've done this inventory of myself through my resentments, my fears, and harms to others, I begin to understand who I am as an untreated addict and what God's job description is for me. So instead of being a dishonest, selfish, self-seeking, and frightened man, my job description now is to be honest, pure, unselfish, and loving. And now I got a track to run on, right? I understand those root causes of what blocks me from God, what the bondage of Cameron looks like. And more importantly, I understand God's job description for me and how to go. Here's another paradox of the program. My character defects of selfishness, self-centeredness, hatred, slander, bigotry, misogyny, misanthropy, impatience, judgmentalness, prejudice, etc. That's my resume as an untreated addict. God hired me with the worst resume to do his will. That's another paradox of the program. God hires us with the worst resumes to do God's will. And we do some pretty amazing things as recovered addicts out there. It really is amazing to bear witness to that. And so I get right with myself. But if all we needed to learn was steps 4 and 5 to what blocks us from God and what gives us access to God, we'd only have 5 steps. But as we all know, behavioral modification doesn't work for us. Cognitive behavioral therapy, dialectical behavioral therapy doesn't seem to have any efficacy for us. So we need a divine intervention. And step 6 and 7 is about getting right with God. Where in step 6, I realize how futile, fatal, and destructive it is for me to live selfishly and self-seekingly and frightened and dishonestly. And I get right with God to say, here, take these defects and give me the courage and the power to be your will. And I practice a life of honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love. And I get right with God. And then I take that job description and I apply it to the carnage of my past. And I clean up the wreckage of my past in 8 and 9. And I get right with others. And that vehicle of 1 to 9 launches me into that 4th dimension of existence, into that spirit world. And through the disciplines of 10 and 11, I'm given a program of living, a recipe of recovery that I can practice each day and maintain that conscious contact, grow in effectiveness and understanding. And having had this spiritual awakening, we then come to the all-important step 12, where we try to carry the message to the addict still suffers and practice these principles in all our affairs. A very balanced program. Take care of family first. Take care of what God has given you. 2, jobs. You got to be self-supporting or you can't look after family. And then in your 3rd, spare time as an avocation, part-time, carry the message the addict still suffers. That's a good balanced program. Nothing ensures immunity as intensive work with other addicts. It works when all the other activities fail. Look at the power we have in step 12. Step 1, we got no power. Step 2, we know there's power out there. We see it working now. There's step 3, we make a decision to find the power. Steps 4 and 5, we realize what blocks us to the power, what gives us access to power. By 8 and 9, we're wielding a power that cleans up the damage of our past and make amends and reparations. And by step 12, we're healing the seemingly hopeless. Everybody's failed the addict. The friends, the family, the employer, the medical community, religious community, treatment center community. Yet we as lay addicts, armed with the facts about ourselves and our common solution, we heal the seemingly hopeless. Now that's power. So the next time you hear that addict crying out for help in the hole, what should we do? Because it only takes a day to learn it, lifetime to practice it. And if you haven't learned the program yet, and you've been in this program a while, you need to put sloth down on your step 4. We can jump into the hole with the untreated addict. And they look at us bewildered and say, now we're both in the hole. But we can turn to our brothers and sisters with a wink in our eye and we can say, hey, it's okay. I've been here before. I got a way out from more hope, faith, and courage, a way out to walk hand in hand with the sunlight of the Spirit, a way out to be intelligent agents, to be spearheads of God's ever-advancing creation. And I'm for that. How about you? God bless you. We'll see you on the firing lines of recovery, everyone.